The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Werke, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. This case is A20-0102, State of Minnesota versus Irving Augusto Borjas Vazquez.
And good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You each will have 15 minutes for your arguments with 5 for rebuttal if appellant chooses to use that. We are recording this hearing, so at the beginning of your oral argument, would you please state your name for the record? And with that, attorney for appellant, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, court staff, counsel, and any other viewers that might be on the Zoom platform. My name is Rory Patrick Durkin, and I represent the appellant Irving Augusto Borjas Vazquez. Your Honors, I've written my brief, and for the most part, I plan to rely on my brief, but there's a few points that I wanted to cover in this oral argument, if I may. And Your Honors, this case really is about fundamental, basic fairness and equality. And more specifically, Mr. Borjas Vazquez.
Well, you're just starting, Mr. Durkin, but I need to interrupt you because we have to figure out how to frame this up. And I'm hearing you argue about the veracity of the court interpreters, but yet what you're appealing is denial of the audio recording. So here we are, we're the reviewing court. We look at whether Rule 4 applies, and Rule 4 says, the transcript is what you get. So how do we get to veracity? If that's not what's being argued here, you're asking for the Rule 4 access.
You're right, exactly. And it's not necessarily about the veracity. More so, veracity might be an incorrect term, and I don't mean that disrespectfully. I would frame it not as veracity of the court reporter, because I think veracity goes to like truthfulness more, as opposed to reliability and accuracy of
qualifications then, or accuracy. But
we can't.
That could have been raised at any time during the proceeding. If your client felt that an interpreter was not doing his or her job adequately or was misstating the evidence, that could have been presented at any time.
But
why was that not done during the hearing?
But Mr. Borjas Vazquez did discuss that with his attorneys and made that clear, as did his wife. But Your Honor, before we even get there, we can't get to veracity or accuracy. And more importantly, Mr. Borjas Vazquez is right. To obtain a record of sufficient completeness to permit proper consideration.
Mr. Durkin, then let me ask you this, because I think we may agree on something. Do you agree that the provisions of Rule 4 prohibit you from getting a copy?
No, absolutely not.
What authority says, in addition to the transcript, that you're also entitled to a copy of the audio recording? And by the way, these hearings cannot be recorded. That's another rule of court. As we're sitting here now, I mean, it's live, but it can't be. You can't have a transmitter in your office and tape this hearing. So how do we get around the provisions of Rule 4? What authority allows you to have a tape, an audio tape?
Well, first off, Rule 2 simply states, and Rule 4 doesn't necessarily prohibit, having a copy of the electronic recording. What Rule 4 states is that the transcript is the entire record and will consist of the entire record. However, just give me a second, I lost my, oh, here we go, sorry. So the contents of an electronic recording can be disseminated by way of transcript only. However, Rule 2, general policy states, records of all courts and court administrators are presumed to be open to any member of the public for inspection and copying at all times. Some records, however, are not accessible to the public at least in the absence of a court order. So there is rule two, the policy that says, hey, look, these records are confidential. They're not going to be disseminated to the public. And rules for our purpose, rule four, we'll discuss the exceptions to the general policy. Rule four doesn't say, hey, nobody ever gets a record. Rule four says, hey, this is one of the exceptions to the general policy of open public viewing and open public records. You get a transcript only and not the recording. But if you need it, you can get a court order. And a court order or a protective order will allow for dissemination. And when we're trying to figure that out, we need to get into a couple of different issues.
Before you start on the issues, let's go back to the transcript. As I understand the record, your client, in this particular case, your client reviewed the transcript for irregularities and possible translation issues. And as it relates to the transcript, he did not find any. I mean, will you agree with that?
I will agree that...
The transcript. I'm only talking about the written transcript.
He didn't say that the transcript was fine. The transcript is only as good as the interpretation. I mean, it's like saying here, we're going to give you an avenue to determine whether or not the transcript is accurate. We're going to give you the transcript, but the transcript, which is the official record, is only as good as the interpretation.
I understand what you're saying, but you do agree then that the transcript, which was a result of what was verbalized in court and heard by the transcriber, did not show any irregularities.
Well, I don't know that. Nobody knows that. Nobody can know that. I mean, look, the transcript, I would concede that the transcript is probably a pretty accurate record of what was stated in open court. But what was stated in open court is only as good and as accurate as the interpretation. If this case were an English-speaking case, there wouldn't be an issue here. But this isn't an English-speaking case. This is an individual that's handicapped in language and is authorized by statute to have an interpreter. And the interpretation is in the transcript and the record is only as good as the interpretation. And there's no way to determine how accurate the transcript is without getting a copy of the electronic recording.
Go back to the trial itself as the trial was played out. I understand that there were two Spanish-speaking interpreters because they relieve each other and they consulted with each other. You were not attorney of record at the time of the hearing?
Correct.
All right. And then the attorney for your client was also Spanish-speaking?
Correct. That's correct. And Your Honor, I understand what you're saying about a possible interpretation of the rule, but when you and clearly counsel has relied on the statutory canon of the plain meaning rule. However, there are problems with the plain meaning rule because the plain meaning rule could or would apply unless, of course, it leads to an absurd result. And in this case, barring any type of meaningful review of an interpretation without unquestionably places. Go ahead, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Can you point to one instance or more that your client now claims he was confused about during the trial?
He has stated all along.
I'm sorry, go ahead. That's my question. Is there any specificity that you can say, oh, gee, when so-and-so was testifying, I was greatly confused. And I understand there was some back and forth on what a salon meant, whether it was a living room or something else. But what can you point us to that demonstrates his confusion?
The testimony of his wife and the interpretation of the testimony of his wife, I know, for one, was a great problem.
In what regard? Not just the testimony. In what regard was her testimony confusing to him?
Well, it wasn't not confusing. Confusing is the wrong word. Misinterpreted.
Misinterpreted, then. What was it that he heard that contradicts what you claim his wife said?
Well, much of the testimony about whether or not the abuse occurred and whether, basically his wife's testimony in general. and just problems throughout with various witnesses and various interpretations.
Well, that brings me to my question, which is the second prong of the test, which is that the defendant must also show that tangible prejudice resulted from the inadequate translation.
And Your Honor, you're right.
Here, let me finish. So in this case, it's hard because we don't have the trial transcript, which the appellant would be the person to provide. And it's my understanding, you just said that your client's wife testified denying the abuse. I know from the PSI that your client also testified and denied the abuse. So apparently the jury was able to hear your client's witnesses who all denied that any abuse happened. And so what is the tangible prejudice if we start from that premise?
Your Honor, respectfully, that question is too soon. We can't get there. Now, let's say that we can't even get to the either.
Well, I think we can, because we can assume for purposes of argument that the interpretation was inadequate. We'll assume that. But then what's the prejudice when your client and his witnesses were able to tell the jury that nothing happened?
Your Honors, if who knows? No, that's the problem here. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. We're talking about a week worth of testimony, volumes of trial transcripts. The transcript and the record and what jurors heard and what was conveyed to the jurors is only as good as the interpretation, and there's no way to determine. We can't get to the standards in her and Mitjen's. We can't even get there. That's premature, because in order to develop the record properly, right? Because we know what the jurors heard. We know what they heard, but we don't know if what they heard was correct. Because
but it sounds to me like that gives you a chance to go fishing for a potential claim. I mean, you don't have anything that you specified. So is that not just looking for a claim?
No, it's not. It's not a fishing. I knew this was going to come up. I mean, I knew someone was going to say, oh, you guys just want that so you can fish. No, I was the first person in our firm to meet with him. The first thing he said is that the interpreters didn't properly translate. He said that also to my partner on multiple times.
Okay, you are arguing to three judges who all were district court judges.
Yep.
And I know that I probably can speak for my colleagues. We all presided over interpreter trials, cases where there are interpreters.
My first jury trial was a Russian interpreter trial that was a nightmare. So I get it.
And I also know that I have had attorneys tell me that their clients are saying that the interpretation's wrong. And that is then goes in the record, and the trial court is able to get at that issue during the trial.
Well, if you look at the trend, I'm sorry, there wasn't a question. I don't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
But there is, so that is part of the issue here, is that there isn't a trial transcript. And so your client says that he told his attorney that the interpretation was wrong, and his initial attorney also spoke Spanish.
That's true. But also the district court judge in this case, who I like a lot, even stated, who stated in the transcript that, look, I didn't do my due diligence. I didn't check with the interpreters and with the counsel to make sure that the interpretation was going correctly. I would assume that it was, but I didn't do my due diligence. Those were her exact words. And we all know what happens when we assume. We can't assume that it was proper. We have an individual whose life is on the line, who is on trial and is not an English speaking individual, and who's consistently stated that the interpretation was not accurate. If there has to be an avenue or a means or a way to determine that and to give plain, to give Rule 4 its plain meaning does two things. It leads to an absurd result, and then there's also unfounded reliance, and the statutory construction is expressio unius est exclusio alterius.
To follow up on Judge Riley's question, how is a reviewing court, are we able to determine, how was the perceived errors, how are they preserved? You didn't bring it up during the course of the trial. We can't wait till a proceeding is over and then go, uh-oh, way back at the beginning, there was an irregularity. I mean, your client had the option at all times to bring this to the court's attention. How do we overlook that?
We do it all the time. That's I simply and respectfully disagree with you. I mean, Your Honors, he stated throughout the trial to his attorneys that there was a problem, but we can't even get there. What we're talking about here is whether or not he can have access to the recording, so he can determine whether or not there were errors in translation, which he has claimed, and which I agree with. I have no reason to doubt that. Nobody has any reason to doubt it. And what is the harm with a judicial protective order releasing the audio so he can review it? There is absolutely no harm, and there's no law blocking it. And if we rely, and it's basically setting up a means and an avenue with which to effectuate a proper appellate review, but then stating, oh, no, you can't ever challenge interpretation. That's beyond absurd. Counsel also relies in her brief on the fact that they didn't.
I'm going to interrupt you, Mr. Durkin. Your time has run already.
Oh, gosh.
Judge Warkey, I saw that you unmuted yourself. Do you have another question?
I'm just going to tip you off. When you come back for rebuttal, I want you to compare this to a claim that the transcript is incorrect based on the testimony that was heard at court.
Thank you. Attorney for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm because the plain language of the rule of public access to records of the judicial branch unambiguously supports the district court's interpretation. The district court simply did not abuse its discretion. Now, upon a claim of inaccurate translation, courts consider on the whole whether the translation was adequate and accurate, and the burden is on the appellant to prove that it was not. And the record here simply does not yield any evidence or even any indication that there were any translation errors or inaccuracies. As was noted already today, there were two court-certified interpreters who were present throughout the trial, and the district court noted that they took time to consult with each other in order to provide consistent translation. Additionally, the defense counsel in this case did represent at the sentencing hearing that they reviewed carefully the transcripts and that they found no irregularities in the transcripts. Furthermore, I think one of the points that is most compelling in this case is the fact that appellant was represented at trial by two defense attorneys who were both bilingual. And so I think especially when looking to a case such as State versus Mitchens, which is cited in both my brief as well as appellant's brief, that case states that defense counsel is always free to object contemporaneously if counsel believes that the court-appointed interpreter is significantly misinterpreting or omitting parts of testimony, and that counsel has the option in the case of the defendant's testimony to, during direct or redirect, explain or have the defendant clarify their answers. This is just even more compelling in a case such as this, where the defense attorneys themselves were bilingual. The other thing I will note is that at this stage of the proceedings, since appellant is saying that his client repeatedly told his trial counsel that he did not understand what was happening, and counsel is representing that that's not reflected in the transcripts, or that his trial counsel did not raise that issue, it sounds like that is something to be addressed more properly in a post-conviction petition if the allegation is that his own attorneys were ineffective because they did not take any action on inaccurate translation that led their client to not understand the proceedings. And we simply don't have such a record below at this time. I am happy to address any questions if the panel has any questions for me at this time.
Judge Werke, I see you shaking your head no. Judge Bradfield, do you have any questions? Thank you.
All right. Then I would just say in conclusion that because the language of Rule 4 plainly bars disclosure of the audio, and because the record here is insufficient to hold that appellant is entitled to any relief, respondent respectfully requests this court affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Durkin.
Once again, good morning, Your Honors. Rory Durkin. I'd like to take my as much of my 5 minutes as well, I'll probably end up taking it all. But Your Honor, you asked me to discuss a transcript, faulty transcript versus obtaining a record. Clearly, the issue with respect to a transcript is whether on the whole the transcript was adequate and accurate. Then we get to the next prong, which, as I think Judge Riley indicated, whether or not there was tangible prejudice. But when you look at the case law, and a couple of cases cite, appellants typically identify specific errors by offering expert testimony in the district court showing that the interpreters failed to adequately or accurately translate statements or testimony. How can we do that if we can't get the electronic copy to determine what was transcribed and what was
accurate? My suggestion would be to you or any other trial counsel is to immediately bring that to the court's attention so the court can stop the proceedings and investigate the claims that are being raised by your client. And I don't know that that happened here. If you're telling me it did, point to me where in the transcript that did happen.
I'm not telling you that that did happen. But still, those are two separate things, Your Honor. That's a contemporaneous objection versus a situation where we have right now, and we did attempt to do proceed by a post-conviction petition, but the court denied it and said the record was sufficiently complete, so we weren't able, you denied us a post-conviction. Just wanted to touch on that for counsel. Your Honors, Rule 4 authorizes release. To rule otherwise would lead to an absurd result. You're saying that nowhere, at no time, at the end of a trial, can a defendant get an electronic recording, even under the facts of this case, and limited a protective order to a recording to Mr. Durkin, Mr. Giancola, and one expert can listen, and then have a post-conviction hearing. That leads to an absurd result. And I wanted to touch on one thing, basically, that counsel discussed it, and it was basically in the statutory canon, the inclusion of one thing indicates the exclusion of the other. There's a problem with that canon, and that's that assumes that the legislature thinks through its statutory language carefully, considering any and all possibilities. This is a unique situation in a unique case, and to deny Mr. Borjas Vasquez a copy of that recording is
let me point out the provisions of playback, and maybe this is what you're getting at, because a recording can be played back during the proceeding, hearing, or trial at the discretion of the court, and I think that's what you're getting at. But what I'm saying to you is during the proceeding, hearing, or trial, not after the jury verdict. So unless there's some offer of proof or something during the trial that would alert the court to say, okay, let's stop and look at this, I don't know how we can get there as a reviewing court.
So you're saying then, so basically you're saying that anytime a criminal defendant doesn't object, even though he discusses it with his attorney, but anytime a criminal defendant doesn't object right away and stand up and say, Your Honors, What's being interpreted here is not correct. Nobody checked with him. He's a Spanish drywall hanger who's accused of crim sex, looking at 144 months in prison. He doesn't have the education that we have. He doesn't have the wherewithal or the tenacity to stand up. He's terrified. He brought it to the attention of his attorneys, and his attorneys didn't say anything. The judge didn't check, by her own words in the transcript. The only way to give him a fair trial and to honor fundamental concepts of justice and fairness and a fair trial is to allow limited access to the recording, which is authorized under the general policy of Rule 2 that states, look, we can get there if we have a protective order and the court can order it, and I have 20 seconds left. So I wanna thank your honors, and I would respectfully request that your honors find that the district court judge incorrectly interpreted Rule 4, because Rule 2 allows for release under a protective order, and that the trial court abused its discretion in refusing to grant a continuance. Thank you very much and have a nice day, your honors.
Thank you. The case is submitted and we will have our opinion out within the 90 days. And that concludes the oral portion of our calendar. We will now recess for the non-oral portion of our calendar. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.